Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Thomas Pierce. His first novel, The Afterlives, was published in January by Riverhead. Thomas is also the author of a short story collection, Hall of Small Animals, and his stories have appeared in The New Yorker and The Atlantic. He's reported for NPR and National Geographic. The Afterlives is one of many new releases dealing with immortality and or the afterlife. The concept seems to fascinate us, and this book takes us even further into the reasons behind that fascination. In The Afterlives, Jim Bird, who's a North Carolina loan officer who has suffered a near-death experience, or actually a death experience, explores, along with his refound love, Annie, the realm we all suspect or want to find, and does so with compassion, passion, and with a realist's view of what mechanism might lead us to its discovery. So with that, welcome, Thomas, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about Jim Bird and how he finds himself in this adventure through time and memory.
Yes, as you mentioned, Jim Bird is a loan officer in a semi-small, medium-sized southern town in the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina, and he's the sort of person who, you know, I think has always looked up to the sky, wishing it would break open and rain down answers. Of course, that's not the way the universe tends to work, and that impulse or that kind of seeker mentality is exacerbated when he, as you mentioned, has this experience, giving nothing away at the very beginning of the book, in which he dies very briefly for a couple of minutes and sees nothing exciting, no lights, no tunnels, no angels singing heavenly songs to greet him, and he returns feeling discombobulated, I would say, and frazzled and uncertain of what it means that he saw nothing.
Yeah, I kind of felt bad for him, I did at the beginning, and I did actually through the book, that he didn't see the light that purportedly most people with near-death experiences see. Tell us a little bit about after he dies, because a lot of people have compared this in a way to Philip K. Dick kind of stuff, which is kind of regular people thrust into an unusual situation.
Sure.
That while it seems fantastic, is not beyond the realm of our imaginations. So, one of those things is HeartNet. So, tell us a little bit about HeartNet and how it works.
Yeah. So the reason he's died is he has a heart condition, an undiagnosed heart condition. And so he suffers a cardiac arrest event, and so to prevent future such events from happening, the doctors, surgeons install a very high-tech version of a defibrillator in his chest. And of course, as you mentioned, this device is not really, it doesn't exist now, but it very well might. Next year. That's my feeling on it. It allows him to monitor his heart constantly via his phone, and kind of a way of constantly investigating the mechanics of his own body at all times, which is unusual. I don't think that's too far away from now.
Yeah, it's like when you're talking about injecting retinas to change the color of the eyes, it's like that is here. People do that, and then sometimes they get damaged because of it. And then the idea of condoms that tell you whether you are encountering disease or not. I don't know if it's here yet, but I have a feeling it probably is.
If it's not, it should be.
Yeah. And then holograms, that's a whole other thing, because they're here and I've seen them. Mm-hmm. But to get to the next step is something that, I don't know, you explore very, very well in the book, but is it something you'd like to see? Is it something you look forward to?
No, it's not. It's not. I mean, I certainly they do exist now, and they have for quite some time. They've gotten more sophisticated, you know, in the last decade or so. I mean, you see them, and you know, they're all sorts. You know, you often see now pop stars resurrected for concerts, and you know, in hologram form, or they're in the airports, and you know, kind of kiosk style hologram. Flight attendants, you know, welcoming you to the airport. So a lot of this stuff is already here. Although at this point, you know, it's very clear that the holograms are holograms right now. And I was imagining a world in which the technology has progressed to a point that it's that you can no longer even tell. And not only that, you don't know exactly where they're being, you know, projected from, which creates a very fundamental uncertainty about, you know, what's even real.
And that's how Jim seems to be, like the way his dentist wants to replace his fillings. My dentist wants to replace my fillings too. You know, they're mercury lead and or whatever they are, mercury silver. And but he kind of looks at it like, is this the real world I'm living in? Did I wake up in a different reality? But
yeah,
it's stuff that it's here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it kind of that's a feeling I have. Quite a bit,
yeah,
for
imagine.
Better or worse. Yeah, I mean, it's just the world is an absurd place when you stop and you know, step back and think about it for a moment. This is not the other day. I was at a gas station and you know, just at a gas pump, and I was for the first time. These have been around a little, not for too long, but for a while. I was kind of taken with it for the first time. These screens inside the gas pumps, and
right.
There's like a news channel that's specific to the gas pump. I mean, there's you know, it's very odd. I mean, this I don't know how long this has been around, but I guess apparently there's like a production company somewhere, I would imagine, that's just exclusively making, you know, news for gas pumps. And it's the world is a crazy place. I never know what quite to make of it. And you know, it's conceivable that 5 years from now, every like cereal box will have its own specific news channel. You can kind of take these things that exist now and extrapolate as a way of highlighting just how absurd things are, as you know, how absurd the world is presently.
I like the way the screens are like covered with tempered plastic, so you can't bust them. And that again reminds me of Philip K. Dick and like Blade Runner. You know, they're all edged. People have tossed stuff at them or marked them with graffiti stuff. It's just like right out of a kind of a dark Blade Runner kind of note. So going back to the concepts in the book. One of the other ones that's fascinating is, and you brought this up in some of your Science in Hall of Small Animals, is talk about Sally, who she is, and then talk about the concept of us existing and the universe mm-hmm. existing essentially 93% of the time.
Yeah, well, there's a story in the book of stories I had out a couple years ago called The Real Alan Gass, and it's a story in which there's this specific type of physics is kind of at the heart of that story, and this thing called the Daisy particle, which in the story is a particle that is blipping back and forth between existence and non-existence, between being and non-being, and it's always bumping back and forth between the two. And so I felt like I wasn't finished with that bit of science. I was interested in toying with that a little bit more, and so it found its way into this novel too, and it plays a large role. So there's kind of, you know, building on that. Well, if every particle is moving back and forth between existence and non-existence, then maybe everything doesn't exist uniformly, and maybe in fact things don't entirely exist at any given moment. So there's this idea that maybe at any moment we only 93% exist, which is put forward in the novel by a scientist whom you mentioned, named Sally Zinker, who's a physicist at UNC, who has retired and is pursuing this physics vis-a-vis ghosts, investigating ghosts, and you know what we might call supernatural events, and looking for kind of a correlation between those unusual phenomena and Daisy physics.
Yeah, it's funny. I have. And I think you touch upon it briefly in the book, but I have this pocket watch, and I had it engraved with the Latin phrase, in omnibus partibus reluca totum, which means in each particle, the whole reproduces itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of got like I don't even know if it was in the book in words, but I kind of got the feeling that you feel that way, like in every little thing we see, that everything is reproduced. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And that's, I don't think I do, it's so explicit in the book, but I mean, even holograms themselves, that's what's so fascinating about holograms is that the whole is contained inside every image. You can't divide it. If you divide it, it's still the whole thing. So yes, I do. I'm interested in that idea, certainly.
Yeah, and I guess to delve further into the book, and always trying not to give away anything.
Yeah.
And there's a particular house in the book, and I was wondering, because it's so well painted, portrayed, why did you choose that particular house? Is it a real house? Does it have a particular past? Did you research it? Or make it all up?
I'm trying to remember. it's been a while. I mean, it was always that house.
Why?
Why? Someone pointed out recently that, where was this? I was with friends, and they were acknowledging that there is a similar kind of restaurant that we had been in around that time, but I don't know if I was thinking of that one or not. I mean, I created it. That's the simple answer. I invented this house, and although I will say that I invented the restaurant, but we were this is a couple of years ago. We were renovating a house and had to pull apart a piece of the chimney, and in doing so, it had uncovered some old letters and short letters, mostly just due bills, like gas and water bills that were these folks who had lived in this house were way behind on. And so we gathered they had been going through a difficult time based on this scant evidence we had here from behind the chimney. And I didn't know anything more about them. I knew their names, and I had found their names on with the city records. They'd owned the property, but I didn't know anything more, and I didn't do much more research than that. But I just loved the idea that they had lived in this house at some point, and we were, in this house now, and that we were occupying the same space, though not the same time, of course. And I enjoyed imagining what their lives might have been like, and those lives ultimately informed the characters who once occupied this restaurant, which is in fact a house, as you noted. Yeah.
Yeah. The closest thing I've ever come to what we've been skirting around, I guess, and what the book goes directly into is, I remember when I lived in Florida, driving by this house, and I got this uneasy feeling every time I drove by the house, and I felt like I shouldn't go in it because there was something bad there, and especially on the second floor. And I went in, and I asked the people if I could, just look upstairs, and just like your stairs, actually. And I went upstairs to the second floor, and I said, I've always felt something. And they go, yeah, there was a murder here.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's the closest I've come to anything like that. And that's very similar to what... Yeah, actually, it's really similar to what happens in the book.
It is. It is. I mean, it's not an unusual story in that way. Sounds like you're a believer of sorts in these sorts of events.
No, I'm like a pragmatist. I didn't want to have that feeling when I drove by. I couldn't help it, and that's what drove me nuts about it. I didn't want to stop, too, because I was scared, but I figured, no, I should stop. But
because it challenged your pragmatism?
Yes, because I wanted it to be nothing.
Uh-huh,
just when I saw this UFO when I was a kid, and they wanted it to be nothing, but I know I saw it, but yeah, I have this duality about, and you seem to kind of have it too. You don't disbelieve it, and you leave your mind open to all these things. Has anything ever weird like that happened to you?
Well, not exactly. I mean, certainly I've had feelings in certain spaces, absolutely. I haven't like seen a ethereal figure moving down a staircase, but I've had feelings, and I also, I've always been interested in these things, and my wife, we've been together about 15 years, and her great-grandfather was a fairly well-known clairvoyant in the earlier part of the 20th century, and her family has a great library of books, not only just about him, but other, psychic phenomenon, studies in a past life, research and what have you. And I've always loved reading those books and digging into that. And it's certainly something I'm open to. And not only that, but reading, there are a large amount of transcriptions of these. He would give readings in a trance state. And there's something like 16,000 of these transcribed readings, and they're quite remarkable. And he was able to give medical, he could diagnose medical conditions remotely, and was often, you know, very often proven, I mean, more often than not, proven correct, was correctly diagnosing people. And so even if you, you know, even if you only believe a fraction of whatever, you know, if you or anyone else read that material and believed a fraction of it, it just has a way of opening the door a little bit. You know, it's that kind of, you mentioned this, you know, seeing a UFO when you're a kid. It only takes like a little bit of that to say, well, wait, what is really going on here? And is it right to shut down, to shut things down just because we don't want them to be?
Yeah, it's a dilemma for someone, and you too, who believes in physics and yet also has this other side of him. It's like the Dalai Lama. Every year he has this conference with quantum physics, mm-hmm. Quantum physicists.
Sure.
And each year things get closer and closer to the way that Buddhism recognizes the essence of the universe. So each time, whether it's a quark or a fermion or something that we're chasing that we can't find, each time it gets closer and closer to the way Buddhism imagines the universe. And I always thought that was fascinating, too.
Yeah, I think so, too. And it's, you know, physics in particular, especially quantum physics, you know, or it has a way of, it's easy to, it leads to, you can lead to a mystical place. There's a lot of, you know, when you get to the outer fringes of it, it almost goes right back around the spectrum toward spirituality and religion. So I find it interesting to, you know, reconciling those two parts of the belief or, you know, what have you.
Yeah, it's like when Einstein, you know, he had the same problem when he said spooky action at a distance, you know?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's like saying, I don't believe in that, but now we know it kind of does happen. You turn something here, and then a light year away, it turns the other way.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's what's so great about physics and quantum physics. And I mean, you know, he's talking about entangled particles there, that phrase, and anything that starts to challenge, you know, our preconceptions or our, you know, what we, anything that challenges our current beliefs, I find very useful and good, you know, positive, and certain physics has that ability to do that. I love that about it.
Well, getting back to the book and still we're trying to sell your books and I'm just going off on different things.
No, I enjoy that.
There's two places that are like protagonists almost. So you have the house where mm-hmm. all this stuff's going on, and then you have the church. So why don't you talk a little bit about the church and what it's about and how things happen there and who gets involved and how that came about, his, you know, Jim's father and all that stuff.
Sure, yeah. So after his... excuse me. After his surgery, he reconnects with an old girlfriend, and the book, I should say, is really, you know, there's a lot of this crazy stuff happening in the book, but it's really at heart, it's a love story. That's the way I think of it, and it's the story of Jim and Annie, their relationship, and I mean, that's really kind of that's its central concern in some ways. But it's Annie who leads him to this church you mentioned, this kind of very new kind of church called the Church of Search, where it functions a little bit like a TED Talks type thing, where different speakers are brought in each week, and the book as holograms. So he starts attending this church, and there's no real pastor or anything like that. It's more like it's just this parade of thinkers, essentially, on various topics, like archaeologists and poets and movie producers, et cetera, people who are leading thinkers in their industry. And so he's drawn to this church and through Annie, and he in turn introduces his father, who's another large character in the book, to this church, who is kind of a like Jim, a skeptic, but craving, you know, something, some kind of meaning, looking for meaning, and he's very much attracted to this church.
You know, it's funny, you talked about Annie and Jim and their relationship and how it is a romance, mm-hmm. which it is. It's mm-hmm. and it's actually cross genres, all kinds of genres in this. But so their relationship, which, without giving anything away, is incredibly poignant for certain reasons. And then you have another poignant relationship between Jim and his father. And then it all kind of goes back to Sally. So without me giving anything away, if you want to, but you don't have to, do you want to talk about what Sally does?
You know. Yes. I mean, I will say that Sally and her, she's broken with mainstream physics, and she has apparently created a machine called the Reunion Machine, which might connect the living and the dead. And that the search for her and for this machine is drives a lot of the action in the book. But it's something that both Jim and Annie and Jim's father too are interested in.
And it really is poignant, isn't it? I mean, it's got a certain sadness, but a certain, well, just like the people experience on the stairs, it has sadness, but it also has a certain happiness and a certain, I don't know, a feeling of discovery. But there's lots of emotions tied to it. And that's part of the book, all the emotions that the reunion machine and the house give rise to.
Yes, certainly. Yeah, and life has all those things.
That's true, but
yeah,
it just. But here it's like, you know, I don't mean to say it this way, but it's like if you hurt your arm and someone pushes on the sore or something, you know, mm-hmm. like you're pushing on spots. And I think that's one of the things that's really good about the book is that you push the spots that people worry about or think about or are concerned about or don't know anything about. And in certain spots of the book, you're like pushing right there, which is kind of what happens to Jim's father, actually. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's really important for, you know, literature or art to be, I mean, I think it should be entertaining. I do believe that. It should be at least, but I think it should also be challenging us in very specific ways. And that's always part of my project. So if it is doing that, then I'm glad for it, if it's pushing at those spots.
I don't know if you've been touring yet or anything, but do other people seem to have... Do you get any weird questions about, you know, why'd you do this, or you shouldn't have done that, why, you know, what, you know, those kinds of things?
I mean, I've certainly had, you know, questions about why this, and you know, what sparked my interest in this, and I have been touring, and I've fielded some questions about what, you know, where this overlaps with my own beliefs, or, you know, where it might. I've heard some, you know, stories from people about their own experiences and beliefs. It does invite that. You know, it's that kind of book that, I mean, there's a lot of voices in this book, a lot of people with thoughts and opinions on what might happen next. And so it, you know, in a certain sense, the book is kind of an invitation to that sort of dialogue. And I can see that. So it's been, I've liked that about it. I've liked when people have come up and shared their own experiences with me, it feels like an extension of the book in a certain sense.
Yeah, it's funny. There was recently two articles, one in the Washington Post, one in the New York Times, and it talked about several books, yours being included, and another one mm-hmm. I just interviewed, I've forgotten what it was, about these five books that dealt with immortality or afterlife.
Right.
And it was discussing. Are you familiar with that?
I've seen, yeah, there are a couple books out early this year that were, you know, thematically, I wouldn't say like overlapping, but
no,
there was a related and somewhat oblique ways. Yeah.
Yeah, there's there's a reason for it. It's like people for whatever purpose, whether it's the political situation or whether it's other things associated with the world, what we were talking about earlier, and as we talked about earlier,
yeah.
Why do you think there is this fascination? What gives rise to it? I know I'm fascinated by it.
Well, I mean, I think it's always been. I mean, it's. I don't think it's something that's. I think it's just a basic aspect to the human condition. I think that's probably, I think it's always been there, but maybe it's exacerbated by the fact that we're living in very uncertain times. That could be part of it. I think we're there's this sense that, reality feels less dependable maybe than it did even a decade ago, or especially two or three decades ago. Maybe at a very basic level, people feel that kind of unraveling, and that can be healthy and unhealthy. I think there are pros and cons to that, but I think it does lead to a lot of big questions. What's really important, and why are we here, and what is the meaning of all this, and how do I live as a decent human being, and what does it mean to be in love with the knowledge that one day, this is impermanent, that this all goes away, that everything is by nature temporary, and trying to reconcile that with this kind of clinginess we feel to life and to each other. And those are things that never go away, but maybe right now in this moment we're especially attuned to them.
Yeah, and I guess the crux of each one of the books on immortality deals with it in a different way, as does yours, but the crux of yours, I felt in a certain way, is that each moment is everlasting. We're always in each moment if we have access to it.
Yeah.
And they never go away. And what her machine does is allows you to access what's already there.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess in closing out, one of the things I wanted to close out with, which is, and this is, I don't think I've ever experienced this in reading a book, the last few pages, and again, without giving anything away, the pace of the book increases like geometrically.
Yeah.
And you're running alongside the book, and it's hard to keep up with it. And you realize, oh, wait a minute, now I get it. Because that was a device that you created.
Yeah.
And if you want to talk about it, you can, but you don't have to. but it was fascinating, because I don't think I ever have encountered it. Maybe in James Joyce somewhere.
Oh, interesting. I was aware of it. It wasn't kind of a front brain design, that. But it arose it somewhat organically as I was writing it, and then once I'd done it, I began to see it. But I have my reasons for it. I am somewhat reluctant to kind of explicate it, but you're right, it's true. And the last part of the book, the last section in particular, time moves a little more quickly. And of course that in some ways is imitative of the way I think life kind of seems to work. I think we've all experienced that time is somewhat elastic, our perception of it. And there are moments when time is elongated, and there are times when it feels very compressed, and that's interesting to me. So I was playing with that a little bit.
Yeah. Now I'm thinking it does remind me of Molly Bloom's soliloquy.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but sure, yeah.
And it's funny because, I don't want to give anything away. Never mind. Well, there's a dog involved. I can say that, right?
Yeah, there's a dog involved. That's true.
And a lot of it rotates around the dog.
Yeah. I can say that time itself, I was very interested in this idea of time. I mentioned this people that had lived in this house and how we occupied the same space but not the same time. I love the idea in physics, going back to physics, that that there's time is not very essential to a lot of physics. It is to thermodynamics, but it's not, we don't know a lot about time. We don't know if it's smooth, if it can flow forward and backward. I mean, there are all these sorts of fundamental questions that we don't get it. We're still trying to figure it out. And there's the possibility that the universe is a bit of an illusion. It's a function of our consciousness, and that in fact all things exist at once, and past, present, future coexist. And that was something I was interested in playing with. So time generally is something I was thinking quite a bit about in writing this. And I'm glad that I'm glad you were picking up on the way the pacing was working.
Yeah, and it kind of works I remember reading Vladimir Nabokov's Transparent Things. You know, you have this room where these things, different things have sat in the same spot on the table. It's like my house. My house was built in 1775, and it has this gigantic fireplace. And when I sit in front of it, I realize that like six generations have done exactly what I'm doing, sitting, looking at a fire. And you can almost feel, like in your book, you can almost feel the weight of these past generations there. You don't see it. You don't cognitively. Well, you do cognitively, but it's just that you know that this is what happened. You know they were there in that spot.
Yeah.
It does create a feeling.
It does create a feeling. And, you know, I think that connection can be very meaningful and life-affirming. And, you know, I do. We have to, feelings are, the Röttgen line, I think by feeling what's left to know. That's one of my personal mantras. There are times when we can know, and there are other times that it's, you can only feel. And I try to remind myself of that all the time.
Well, it's been fascinating, and I really loved your book. I own an independent bookstore, and I was just placing your book on the front table today. So,
thank you.
Hopefully this will help out, too. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise. I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Hey, we were talking with Thomas Pierce about his new book, The Afterlives, which is a really great look into the concept of immortality, of time sitting on top of every place and every place sitting on top of time. And I don't know what the hell that means to us, but kind of like everything happening at once. And you never lose a moment or an event. It's just inaccessible for the most part. And I guess what he does in the book is make it accessible, those moments. So I hope you continue joining us on The Avid Reader. Our upcoming guests include Gina Showalter, who's discussing the final installment in her Everlife series, which is a young adult series, but I read all three of the books, First Life, Lifeblood, and Everlife. I read them all three in like 2 days. They're really good books. I mean, as an adult, you can read them, kind of like the Divergent series or The Hunger Games or even Harry Potter. And then Andrew Sotelo will discuss his latest book, Soon, An Overdue History of Procrastination, which I intend to not read or finish until the very moment before the interview. And then we got a bunch more coming up, which I can't think of now. But we definitely, Rebecca has done a great job of lining up some great books. And she has her finger on the pulse of what's going to be a big knockout bestseller coming up now, I guess soon. I can't believe the year's gone by this fast. But coming up soon to the summertime reads. So in any event, I enjoyed my interview today with Thomas. And I look forward to my next one. I hope you do too. And we'll see you here on The Avid Reader.